Yeah, well, it's the peanut butter inside of those two cheese crackers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, half of the bricks are peanut butter.
Probably, I think so, yeah.
Where do we start this? And the answer doesn't matter. We're having a good time. Right.
He couldn't wait to get in here.
You need sales balls to make sales calls. I'm tweeting that puppy. Okay. Hi, everybody, and welcome to another adventure and lesson inside of Sell or Die podcast. My name is Jeffrey Gittimer. I'm the author of The Little Red Book of Selling, and
I'm Jen Gluckow, founder and CEO of Sales in a New York Minute.
And together, we're going to make sure that you learn to earn, and we have an amazing show today. I mean, literally an amazing show today. Our guest is C. Lee Smith, founder and CEO of Sales Fuel, and he's going to talk about sales leadership, culture, and how his company uses data to help salespeople conquer the discovery part of the sale and why that's been a key to his success and how it can work for you.
But first, we're busy here working on a new course for the Gittimer Learning Academy, and it's all about value. So let's take some time to talk about why value is important to a sale.
I don't know. Why is it?
Well, every sales rep feels like they need to give value.
Value, in my opinion, is the most bantered sales word on the planet. Most people couldn't define it if you made them bet. I almost said put a gun to their head, but it's not a good thing in these days.
I've hired a bunch of salespeople in my past, and they've all said, or most have said upon their first week, what's our value proposition?
Yeah.
Or I need to memorize our value proposition.
No, seriously? Our value prop.
Yeah. email.
So let's look at what value add and why added value is bogus, and then we can talk about what it really is. That's probably the easiest way to do it. A guy is going to sell you a car, and they'll say, well, we will give you, as part of this deal, a free oil change every 6 months or every year, and we'll give you an extended warranty. That's our value add. In other words, if you don't buy from me, you don't get anything. You're not going to give me like a roadmap to get from here to Jersey. Mm-hmm. You're giving me something that I have to have my own car to get. Do you understand? Mm-hmm. They're using it as a hook or a sales tool in order to be able to get it.
And you have to really hope that you care about that kind of value.
Correct.
Okay, because some people may not care about the extended warranty. When I go to a store and I'm buying a TV, I don't buy the upgraded warranty.
No.
So why would I care if I'm going to get it for free? If I wouldn't pay for it anyway.
So let's use the car dealership while we're beating the heck out of them. Don't you have a car guy that you love?
I love Eli. He's the best.
What's his value prop?
So before I ever even purchased a car from him, and that's the key here, is that it was done before, he said, take out your phone, put my number in your phone, anything you need, I will help you with. You don't call this main number if you know. And of course, it was dependent on me buying the car, but if I didn't buy the car, he had nothing that he could help me with anyway. It's not like he's going to go get my groceries.
The personalization aspect of it, though, was the hook.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, because the extended warranty is just a piece of paper with a lot of words. Most of them I don't understand.
There's a lot of words there.
Nor am I ever going to cash in on.
Right.
But okay, so what Eli would do is I would text him and say, Eli, I need to get my car serviced. That little light thing came on. And he'd say, no problem. I'll set it up for you. Just let us know what time we could pick it up tomorrow. And then I wouldn't even drive to the dealership. He'd come get my car.
Right.
Put a loaner car there. Then and it would just be in my spot, and then return my car when it was ready and take the loaner car. That's value.
There's no argument with that. It's value to a point where you can't even describe it. It's not added value. It's incredible value.
But that
it's kind relationship building value.
Mm-hmm. Because that kind of value that I'm now getting after the sale is ensuring my repeat business.
Agreed. So let's look at value as something that might entice me to make the sale because I'm so surprised, but also entice me to come back again and buy more. We are blessed with a young daughter who just turned 8 years old, and were we there to do a seminar?
You were giving a seminar at
Yeah. I don't want to mention the name of the hotel. It's a Gaylord Texan Hotel right outside of the Dallas airport. And we called up, you know, we have a high level rating at the Marriott, whatever they are, and told them that it was Gabrielle's birthday. That's all we said.
Well, you may have mentioned your name.
Oh, true. Okay.
And the general manager of the hotel.
Oh, yeah, he already knew me.
Knew you from working at other hotels in the past.
The bottom line was we arrived there and we didn't have a high expectation, you know, a birthday cake or something. And we walked into a birthday emporium.
An extravaganza.
It was a bonanza. It was amazing. I mean, they decorated the whole room. They had 15 cupcakes for the three of us.
It was like Christmas on your birthday.
Literally.
She had presents. She had stuffed animals.
It was crazy.
Balloons all over the place.
Bath bombs. They put together these packages from the spa.
It was pretty cool.
That's value after you.
Yeah, value after.
Yeah,
that's correct.
So now you are going to Dallas. Would you ever stay anywhere besides the Gaylord?
There is not even a prayer.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, let's throw one other thing in here. Marriott's are a Pepsi place, and I don't understand why people like Pepsi, but some people do. I'm not one of them. They had a Coca-Cola refrigerator in my room full of Coca-Cola.
Specifically that they bought for you and your stay.
Incredible. So
wait. But how did they know you like Coca-Cola, Jeffrey?
I don't know.
They did their research.
Oh, they did do their research. That's true.
And this show is about discovery so that you can do those kinds of valuable things for your client. Because if they didn't know you liked Coca-Cola.
Now, it's not going to say I like Coca-Cola over Pepsi on my LinkedIn profile.
No.
But if you...
They might.
They might.
Interests. Coca-Cola, not Pepsi.
Yeah. But, you know, I've been a loyal customer of Coca-Cola for 55 years. I've written about it.
So since you were one?
Well, I tell the story of my dad and grandfather owned a motel in Atlantic City. And for a nickel or a dime, you went down and you got the Coke machine and it was so cold that it would turn to ice, you know, when you got it out of the machine. But you'd look at the bottom of the bottle to see where it came from. And it was always Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
And so if you know that, then you know I have the affinity for that. But I think that what they did there was so over the top that it wasn't even funny.
Mm-hmm. And how does that kind of value versus an extended warranty or some kind of value add, how do those extraordinary acts work to beat competition?
Two ways. Number one, they didn't say, if you come, we'll give you a birthday party. It was a surprise. So it was unexpected value. That's number one. And number two, I'll tell that story for 20 years.
The biggest difference also is that those two things are experiential. Okay.
Yeah, right. You can't compare them.
No one's
going to
tell a story about an extended warranty.
Right. And the extended warranty only goes into play if something goes wrong.
Right.
So it's not like it's this extended warranty that's helping you every day or doing something extravagant for you. But if it breaks, then.
Well, and if one company gives a 1-year extended warranty, another company could come over the top and give a 2-year extended warranty.
Exactly.
But nobody
knows.
But I might not even care about whatever it is in 2 years or 3 years.
Right.
You know?
Right. So those big extraordinary acts, really tough to compete with.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
And they become memories, not simply stories. They become tied to the fact that something memorable happened at this particular place. But I have to tell you that Gaylord Hotel, they go over the top for everything.
Oh, they do. You know, I'm sure we have listeners right now who are salespeople that say, oh, well, my company doesn't do this. We don't offer value like that.
Right.
And the answer to that is, but you can. You, as a salesperson, have the ability to be available to your clients, to get texts, to do certain things, to go above and beyond where you're offering value and make a difference.
Let me give you the question you need to ask yourself. How much money do you spend in marketing to attract a lead?
Mm.
And then once you have the customer, how much money do you invest in keeping them? And the answer is it's probably $1 million to $1. $1 million to $1. And that's where companies fail. They fail to invest in keeping the customer that they've invested in to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
It's uncanny to me. So what I think we should do right – oh, you want to talk more about it?
Well, no, I was just going to say that before you can even offer value, you have to have the right attitude. You have to have a yes attitude. And along those lines, you're re-releasing a book – Tell us about it, Jeffrey.
I am. I'm re-releasing the Yes Attitude book. It was 10 years old in its 10th printing, and we decided to revise the entire thing, call it a new edition, added 20 pages, made a bunch of revisions, and it basically, even if you own the old version, you should buy the new version. It's that
yeah, there's
much,
new stories and new information yeah. in the new version.
And it's you know, we're selling the course online, a Yes Attitude course, not just from the book, but all kinds of other stuff about attitude. And we have a contest.
Yes,
and
we
if you're
do.
Willing to enter this contest, you're going to win.
Well,
or you could win.
You could win. So here's the deal about the contest. You could win a trip to Charlotte, North Carolina. Jeffrey's going to pay for your trip here, and you'll spend the day getting coached by Jeffrey. You'll spend time in the studio. You'll meet me. You'll meet Doug. You'll meet the team. You'll visit Jeffrey's library, learn about podcasting, come on our show, writing, sales, whatever you want to learn that day. You will spend a day with Jeffrey, and you will get to pick his brain. But here's what you have to do to enter. Dun, dun, dun. I feel like we need a little drum roll.
Okay, so think about this. If you own the gold book of Yes Attitude, that's one of the keys. And Jen is going to go into the detail of what it's going to take to enter the contest. It's not real tough, and you could win.
So we want to know how the book has affected your Yes Attitude. So what you need to do is record a video detailing why and how your Yes Attitude has changed your life. It doesn't have to be long. It can be a 1 or 2 minute video on your iPhone, but record a video telling us how and why your Yes Attitude has changed your life. Then you need to upload that video to YouTube. Title your video, Jeffrey Gittimer Gave Me a Yes Attitude, and share it to your social media platforms.
Stick
it's
it
really
up on
simple.
Facebook, yeah.
Record the video, put it up on YouTube, title it, Jeffrey Gittimer Gave Me a Yes Attitude, and then share it everywhere you can. Hashtag Yes Attitude, hashtag Gittimer, tag Gittimer so that he knows you're posting this stuff. And the more times you share, the more potential you have to win.
The shorter the video, the better. The shorter the video, the more powerful it will be. It doesn't even need to be 42 seconds if you do it right. I have a feeling a short video is going to win, but I'm not really sure.
So winners can learn whatever they want to from you, even how the Eagles are going to win the Super Bowl.
Yes, that's going to be a very short course.
And I will say this, knowing Jeffrey, I have a feeling he's even underselling what the win is, because normally he likes to give tons and tons of value, and I have a feeling there's going to be some surprises along the way.
Some autograph stuff and some books and maybe a subscription to the Learning Academy. We'll see what's going on, but it'll be exceptionally valuable to the winner. All you have to do is post the video and play it up on your social media.
That's right. And the contest is going to expire before the end of the year. The sooner you get it in, the better. And the more you share it,
and
better.
We will announce the winner on
Facebook Live.
Huh?
Facebook Live.
Oh, on Facebook Live. Oh, that's really cool. Yeah. We don't know when, but the winner will be announced.
Yeah, yeah. We'll be in Paris probably when we announce the winner, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. An international winning announcement.
Oh, yeah.
So what's going on here now?
Well, it's time for our interview with C. Lee Smith.
Ooh, I actually like C. Lee Smith. he is a great guy, and he's a smart guy.
Super smart guy.
Huh?
He's phenomenal.
This interview will redefine how you think about the use of data.
Get ready for some value. Lee, we are excited to have you on the show today.
I think his name is C. Lee, isn't it?
But we can go by Lee. That's great.
Oh, you do?
My phone as C. Lee, but that's very funny.
Yeah, I know he's in my phone as C. Lee also.
So, you know, on the super, it's C. Lee Smith, but you can just call me Lee. That's great.
Okay, yeah, cool. You dropped the C.
Yeah.
That's much more friendly.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're like a regular guy.
Usually.
Yeah. Don't call me, can I call you C? No. All right. We'll just go with Lee.
Just Lee.
So, Lee. First question from me is you're a leader of leaders, and your people in your company, how many employees do you have?
30.
30 employees, and they are there to feed you information so that you can be a better or be perceived as a better leader of leaders?
The way I see it is the better information I have, the better decisions I can make. So, yeah, I take in all kinds of information. I want feedback. A lot of times it's stuff I don't want to hear, but that's the kind of stuff that I need to hear to be able to make the best decisions I can.
But you also sell information.
That's true.
So you have a bunch of data gatherers all over hex half acre, because you don't want to say hell on a podcast. People might get upset.
Okay. What? We're rated E.
Huh?
I thought we were rated E.
Oh, we're rated E for everybody.
All right.
So you collect data. And how important is that data in the success of your business?
It's a great question. Data itself is really not particularly that important, because everyone talks about big data and they have to have more data. But the thing is, what people are really looking for is they're looking for insight. They're looking for that one nugget of information that we can go out and share that with a client or a prospect, something that they didn't know themselves, or something that, if nothing else, sets them up as being knowledgeable or subject matter expert in the field, and helps them stand out apart from the other schleps that come in through the door trying to sell them something.
Yeah, but what about I want to make more sales and I need data about what percentage of people are clicking on this page, or what percentage of people buy this particular product, or how long do they linger on this page, that kind of
thing. Now, that kind of stuff is incredibly important, but it's incredibly important only if you get to the why. Okay, so why are these people lingering on this page? Why are my numbers only this much? What should my numbers be? What is the average for the industry, and why am I not there and managed to the gap? So that's where the insight part of it really comes into play.
How do you figure out that why?
The why deals a lot with the type of business, the industry, because they're all a little bit different. It also deals with the companies. They're all a little bit different. It deals with the people within those companies. They're all a little bit different. So the discovery process is absolutely critical, I believe, to a salesperson. And I believe one of the reasons why salespeople struggle to close so much is because they've done a poor job in a discovery process. I haven't uncovered the insights that give them leverage and that allow them to craft solutions that are either going to solve problems or help them meet their aspirational goals. So discovery is key, and that's how that insight is actually used.
I'm a sort of a bigger picture sales guy. I don't get caught up in data. I try to sell the emotion of it rather than the logic of it. If I have to quote a number, you know I use 74%, right? But I think that in today's world, data is actually calming. If I'm sitting with a customer, I think I can make him or her more calm by saying, this is what's happening in the market. This is what's happening at your place. And you're ahead of the market. Let's stay ahead. Or you're behind the market. Let's get up to, just based on your data.
Emotion leads to motion. No doubt about that. But you're absolutely right. Where the data comes into play is it can be supportive. It can be reassuring. But I also believe it works really well the other direction, though.
It can be alarming, right?
That's true, too. But I also actually believe it's like, okay, let's gather the facts first before we form a conclusion, rather than here's a solution, here's some facts to back that up. And too many people actually do it the wrong way, the latter of the two ways I just mentioned.
So how did you get into the data collection and being obsessed with leadership and culture? Talk to us a little bit about your background. A
couple different questions there. So the first question, as far as the whole data thing, I'm a nerd. I'm a geek. And so my entire company, we have a culture.
Self-proclaimed being, nerd.
Absolutely.
I love it.
Part of our culture is like there's five things you have to be successful in our company. And one of them is nerd friendly. So that's actually written.
That's pretty cool. Is that your slogan?
That's actually, we have five things, five criteria.
And what are the other four?
Well, you have to be smart. You have to be high. You have to be hardworking or self-directed, as another way of saying that. You have to be caring. And,
friendly. Well, I think it's
kind.
Funny as hell.
Well, yeah, absolutely. So
that's cool.
Past history of success, I think.
Absolute past history of success. Absolutely. Is a proven track record. You have to be a winner. And it's like, when we look for winners, we don't necessarily say, oh, well, this person increased sales from this number to that number in a previous job. Certainly that's part of it. But I also want to take a look at it and say, okay, hey, you managed something for a nonprofit organization or whatever. And wow, it was a smashing success. Mm-hmm. Or you coached your kid's baseball team and your kid's baseball team was really lousy, but they actually ended up finishing year 500 or whatever. So that you've shown improvement there. So that's what kind of winning
we're
looking for.
So it's business success and community success.
Success is success. Yeah. You know, so it's like, I want to see both, because usually you have one, you have the other. Unless you really hate your job, you're not going to have the business success. Or you've got a lousy company that's not very supportive. That's a possibility, you won't have it there. But that's also on you, because like, it's a free country, so you can get out and go work somewhere else.
And so how did you start with this? Did you just like collect numbers?
Or? So yeah, coming back to that, thank you, when I started off, I feared small talk. And it's like, how are you starting a sales conversation? I'm having to go out and meet with these people. And I didn't feel really comfortable talking about their kids or the weather or sports teams or anything like that. So what I would do is I would maintain file folders of things, magazine articles, newspaper articles that I would rip and read, and I would file them away by business type. And then before I'd go out and see a client or a prospect, I would take that along with me, and that would be my opening line. Hey, I came across this thing I thought you'd be interested in. And it's like, you know, how does that pertain to you, or is that what you're seeing too? And that is how I was able to open sales conversations, because I really wasn't good at the small talking.
That's cool. So you broke the nerd barrier by walking in prepared.
Exactly.
Otherwise, you're sort of fumbling. But you had something specific to say.
Right.
In the sales process, it's referred to as preparation.
Yes.
We recently had Sam Cayucci on from One Huddle, and he was saying that they built these games, these, you know, gamification things, to give millennials data to be able to talk about. So it's like a very similar concept. And I think it's probably not just you who didn't feel comfortable, doesn't feel comfortable going in and talking about the weather or the kids or the baseball game or whatever it may be, but having actual knowledge and actual information to go into a sales conversation with. So how have you seen that affect salespeople that are getting to use it?
I think that when you're prepared, you have more confidence. When you have more confidence,
absolutely.
I mean, you're gonna be a better performance. Yeah. So, you know, it's sort of like Deion Sanders, right? That's one of your favorite quotes.
Yeah, it's like, when you look good, you feel good. When you feel good, you play good. When they play good, they pay good.
And so the same thing applies here. If you're prepared, then that's the best way basically to calm the nerves and to go in there, sound like a subject matter expert, and really present yourself in that way. And they pick up on that.
Okay,
it's a nonverbal.
But here's the deal. That subject matter expertise has to blend with the customer's genuine needs or desires.
Always.
Or your...
Well, okay, and that's another good point, because so many people these days, particularly like out in Silicon Valley, they feel like discovery. Okay, I'm going to go hit the website, I'm going to go on Google and do a Google search, and then I'm going to go on LinkedIn or whatever and get the... And they think that's what discovery is. Okay. And that's not even... That's just a start.
What Jen just brought up was this guy, Sam Cayucci from One Huddle. And what happens is you can do this data transfer from people by handing them your phone and say, I'd like you to play this game. Percentage of people buy on the first time they come to your website? And you show four numbers, and you know the right number. Mm-hmm. The right number is 74% or whatever it is. And you ask them to click, and now they're keeping score on what their own answers are.
And competing against all these other people on the same game and the same kind of data.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty cool.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know that I'd want people to have my phone.
But well, they don't need your phone. Okay, they can use their phone.
Yeah, you can just use any old phone. You can just bring a dummy phone.
Just for the record, do you have an iPhone?
Absolutely.
Okay, just making sure.
Because it works. Always.
I think you come up green, though.
Green? You mean as on iMessage?
Yeah, I think you're not blue.
Well, that's unusual.
No, he's blue.
He's blue?
I got to be blue.
Yeah,
I thought he was green.
No, he's blue.
Okay.
I could send you a sticker.
Well, he's a logical person, therefore he's green.
I'm about
thinking
money,
about money?
Man. Give me the money.
I love it. Okay, so you're really into leadership. Some might say you're obsessed with leadership.
It's completely.
Actually, no, he's obsessed with culture.
Obsessed with culture, yes.
Talk to us about that.
Well, when working with a lot of folks with our discovery product and with our sales intelligence, the logic might be, it's like, oh, the salespeople aren't being trained. The salespeople just aren't using it. The salespeople aren't doing what they should be doing to prepare for sales calls. And really what we found to be true was it's not the salespeople who aren't performing well. It's the managers who aren't performing well, because the managers didn't know it existed. The managers weren't really holding their salespeople accountable for doing their jobs, for prospecting, for being prepared for
every salesperson
calls.
Right now is saying, hell yeah.
Oh, damn right.
Yeah, it's my damn manager's fault. That's why
I
suck.
It's not my fault.
Well, I mean, it's like, you know, but as a manager, it's like, yeah, if majority of your people suck or whatever, guess what? You know, chances are you probably suck. So,
right. So how do you help them?
So really what we have to do is, you know, like we help anybody, we do baseline study. We find out where the weaknesses are as far as their management skills, their leadership skills, their team culture, and also how they develop their individual people. And we find out from the employees themselves what they think the situation is, because the managers always think it's different than what the rank and file think. Every study we've ever done. And from that, though, we compare that to what is their team standard to what is the standard for their division or their group or their region? And then how does that compare then to the corporation overall or to the company overall?
Or their competition.
Yeah. It's like if we have that data. But certainly, we definitely have it for the entire company. And so if we see that they're lagging behind in certain key areas, where again, we coach to the gap. So then what we're able to do then is take some great articles that we've written, hundreds of articles that we've written, as well as videos that, you know, two of the industry greats sitting right here have done, as well as our own.
Oh, here.
Yeah, here, right here.
Okay, cool.
Right here, right now.
Exactly. So it's like whether it be on sales, whether it be on marketing, whether it be on operations, professional development, leadership, management. What we do is like we chunk those down then and actually prescribe those then to the managers. Like, okay, here are areas that you need to work on, along with coaching questions then, so that their managers can then have a follow-up conversation. 5 minutes, we call that quick coaching. And the idea is we came up with that because like when we were out in the field and promoting coaching then as a prescription for what ails a lot of managers, it's not the managers just have to coach the salespeople, but someone's got to be developing the managers too.
Mm-hmm.
And it just takes too much time. There's not enough time in my day. I've got a million reports I got to do. I got meetings that it does. Like, there's no way I'm going to have time to do all that. So we cut it down. You know, watch this 5-minute video, 5-minute conversation, done.
I think most people like to digest information in 5-minute chunks now anyway.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously our listeners are going to listen to the whole podcast. It's longer than 5 minutes.
But they might
listen
to it in chunks. They might kind of say, okay, that's a great topic, but now I'm going to get out of my car and go work out, or I'm going to go to the grocery store. I'm going to come back, get my car.
Or I'm late for my sales appointment, or I'm, you know.
I hope you're not late.
Well, you know what I mean.
I can't. Oy vey.
You have to put yourself in a position where my time allocation is more important to me than the length of your broadcast or the length of your lesson.
That's right.
So I'm gonna do it in my own time. Thank you. And the shorter, the better.
Yeah, shorter chunks are more digestible.
For sure. Okay, so talk to us. Give us a chunk on culture.
So culture is absolutely a critical part of developing high-performing teams. And you develop high-performing teams first by developing high-performing managers. So we start there. And of course, the biggest manager of them all is the one at the very top. So it starts there, and that's not a surprise to anybody. But what sometimes people fail to remember is that the ones who have the most impact on culture is your direct manager. Instead, whether it be a Gallup poll, whether it be our own poll at Sales Fuel, we all find the same thing, that nearly 50% or something slightly over 50% of salespeople have voluntarily left the company because they hated their manager or they had an issue with their management. Their direct manager. So they are the ones that set the standards about what's acceptable behavior, what's not acceptable behavior, what's acceptable performance, what's not. But also it's like, okay, how are we going to behave and how are we going to treat each other here within the company? So it starts there.
I have never – every audience that I'm in, I ask how many of you have ever had a manager or a boss who was a jackass? And they all raise their hands.
Yeah.
And then I say, well, how many of you are bosses? And then like 20% of the audience raise their hand and go, it could be you.
It could be you. Yeah. It could. So a key part of that, though, is particularly with the younger sales force that we have these days is that they're looking for more coaching. They want to be developed. Not only, and they want to have that constant feedback. Am I doing the right job? Am I on the right track?
Hang on a second. They want to be coached their way.
Well, of course.
They want to be coached in a way where they feel comfortable about taking the coaching.
That's
where
right.
They feel relaxed about taking the coaching. They don't want to be admonished to start out with. They want to be encouraged, held.
Positivity all the way.
But we all have different styles of
That's
learning.
Absolutely right.
And so it makes sense to help someone learn in the best way that they can learn.
And I think a key part of that, though, is the discovery process has to apply then to your people, not just to your customers. So you have to know everything. So what style does it? Can I be more direct with this person? Or is this person all about getting along with people and being a peacemaker? Or is this person about wanting to stand out and be above everybody else? And knowing those types of styles, but also knowing what motivates them. It's like, I'm motivated to make more money, or I'm motivated to go out and help people, or to learn all I can, or I kind of like being a rebel and breaking the rules now. And if that's your motivation, we play to that, we speak to that, and you coach to that. And so that's a very key part. So the discovery process absolutely applies to management as much as it does applies to a salesperson going out on a sales trail.
I think that there's an ability for everybody to understand the coaching process because they see it on sports and they watch the coach with their little game board and stuff like that. But really, the bottom line is the coach has to be accepted. And if you're in the listening audience right now, you might want to go back and study Jack Ramsey, coach of the Portland Trail Blazers, and before that, the Hawks of St. Joseph's College, where he was a doctor of coaching, you know, physical education coaching. And he created this thing called whole part whole when he coached. And he won a champ, beat the 76ers in 1977 when he shouldn't have with Bill LeWiner Walton and a few other people. But he would he would go back to paint the picture of what's the goal here?
What does success look like?
Yeah. Okay. And then the part is, what is your part in doing this? And then the final is, how are we going to play together to be able to make this happen? Whole part whole. An incredible, way ahead of its time process that has basically been overlooked in the whole coaching arena, but so logical and so right that I try to employ it all the time just because I understand it. And so, I also love Jack Ramsey.
So John Davidson then, who's general manager of the Columbus Blue Jackets, where my company is located, but formerly of New York Rangers, and of course, great goaltender as well. He was talking about how he's going to build the team because the Columbus Blue Jackets have been underperforming, underachieving pretty much since their
inception
there in 2000.
And not like the Flyers, by the way, that their third year in the league, they made the playoffs.
They set the house on fire and then have stunk ever since then.
That's just bullies. Exactly. Well, the Broadsheet Bullies left the team
I think when Kate Smith died or whatever, like that was pretty much the end of it.
Yeah, that could have been it.
But nonetheless, he says, he's like, we build a team brick by brick. And so we focus on having better bricks. I like to say, though, it's not just the bricks, it's the mortar. So it's really what holds the team together and holds the bricks together and gets them to perform as a wall. And so
I love that analogy. That's a good one.
Yeah. So it's about the mortar as much as it is the bricks.
Brick wall. I like it.
Yes. Unlike the Philadelphia Flyers goalies, but yeah.
So what are you doing that's unique at your company that sets it apart in terms of culture?
I like to say that culture is what brings people together and what sets teams apart. And so it's what the last part is, like, what do we do that makes us different than everybody else? And so it could be the charities that we support. It could be the little traditions that we have, the little turns of phrase or the special little language that only people in a certain company know.
The little inside jokes.
But they feel like an insider.
Exactly. Yeah. It's that sort of thing. It could just be the little things that we do that's unusual. And hopefully unusual is good. But before that, though, it's what brings us together. So again, that's the mortar part of the bricks and mortar. So
let me expand on that. It's what brings them together and keeps them together.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. The mortar is, we're in a building at the old Lance Cracker Factory that was built in 1928, 29. Mm-hmm. The bricks are still together, held by the mortar.
Yeah, well, it's the peanut butter inside of those two cheese crackers.
Yeah. Well, half of the bricks are peanut butter.
Probably, I think so, yeah.
But that is the challenge. You have to keep your team together and you keep your people together. It's one of the reasons that sports has become really less exciting to me because the guy who I loved now plays for the team that I hate.
Mm-hmm. He's taking his talents to some beach somewhere. Yeah.
Well, not just that, but they tend to go to the team that you despise.
When Durant, you're talking about Durant right now, I'm guessing. Going to Golden State.
It is what it is.
Okay, so how do you keep them on the team?
So that is all about retention. So the idea there is that you start by improving the managers then have to improve each individual person and develop them, because that's what the younger workforce is looking for now and really demanding from managers. It's not just an expectation or a wish or whatever. It's something that if they don't get it, they're gone. They're going to go somewhere where they're going to find it.
And it's managers over money. Like, you can't always pay everybody the maximum amount of money, but some people might stay for a little less money because they love the
manager. Because they love the manager, yeah. And or they leave because they hate the manager. So they'll take less money to get away from that manager.
Bingo.
And so it's improve your managers, improve your people, but that leads to being able to improve your culture, because the culture is really not what the manager says it is. It's what the people say it is.
Yeah.
And it's their perception that really counts, because they're the ones that, you know, that – they are the culture. The manager can influence that, and they can set the standards and everything like that, but they are the culture. It's what they think it is that matters.
So how do you go about doing the research for a specific company to find out what that culture is?
There are several different metrics for that. I mean, the first one you have to take a look at is retention rate. So if you got people that are leaving at a rate that's higher for your industry standard or whatever, you got a problem. Mm-hmm. The second thing you got to look at is, like, how much time are you spending interviewing people in your office? If you're doing a lot of that, you got a problem.
Mm-hmm.
How much time are you losing then? How many man hours are you losing because of, you know, people are out sick for an unordinate amount of time? They're taking vacation whenever they can. They're taking long lunches. They're coming in late, leaving early. Those lost man hours are also an indicator. But then it really becomes all about what the employees say it is. And so you have to do an employee perception study. And for example, we've identified 48 different metrics for identifying a company culture that contribute to that. And the way to do that is to do a 360, not just asking what the managers, what they think it is, but then also taking a look at what the employees say it is. And then you manage to the gap. So the gap then also is how you develop the manager. But the gap is also then what I need to do to be able to improve my people and improve my culture overall. So once I have improved the team development cycle works like this. If you improve the managers, you improve the people, that improves the culture. And if you have an improved culture, now the manager is able then to go out and recruit higher quality talent and also be able to keep the talent that they want. And that also again gives them the liberty then basically to cut the cord, cut any cancer out of an organization, get rid of them faster because they know they have other people on the bench that are uniquely qualified for the job.
Is there a gap measuring metric?
Yeah.
Like if there's a 5-degree gap or there's a 28-degree gap or there's a...
I mean, absolutely. So it's like the bigger the gap, the bigger the problem, right? So, but also how that can also be used is by upper management. It's like, hey, that manager is really kicking butt, you know, in the area of meeting effectiveness or their coaching skills or the way that the employees trust that particular manager. What's their secret? What are they doing better than everybody else? So you can look at it from a negative, okay, here's the gap. You can also look at it from the positive and say, okay, what is that person doing? Okay, and then how can we get other managers to model that kind of effectiveness and behavior?
I'm going to throw an example out just for the audience perspective. I did a bunch of seminars for a large automobile manufacturing company, and they were selling aftermarket parts. So I had everybody have a spark plug on their table. Not just to be fired up, but in the old days, they didn't replace spark plugs, they fixed them.
Wow.
They had a little file that went in between the spark plug thing in the gap between the fire and the spark plug. And if it had a little carbon on it, it didn't fire right. And you lost all the power in your car.
Did you talk about a little bristly thing that you
would
go in?
Yeah. So they measured that gap in microns. Mm. And the slightest little bit would cause you to not fire well and not perform well. And I think that the gap
analogy.
It's a real good analogy. In fact, you should actually go around and give spark plugs out if you're going to do gap stuff.
Okay.
But what happens is that the people don't understand that that you say the word gap, but it's like how critical is that gap?
Is it the Grand Canyon kind of gap or is it?
You know? Yeah.
Right. Oh. And companies die when they don't deal with that gap. You look at Borders Bookstore as an example of a company.
Yeah, what? Exactly. What's that?
Well, their gap was that they didn't understand that online was more important than in store.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had a partner with Amazon and they abandoned it.
Yeah.
They said, oh, we can build our own website better. Death.
Barnes & Noble, the Nook.
Well, listen.
Yeah, they're next.
All right, so your TeamKeeper app,
mm-hmm.
does it do the how does it work?
So the way that that works is that we use the analytics. So as far as understanding how effective the manager is as far as managing their people, managing their skill set, and also managing the culture. And so to help that aspect, we help the manager, though, be able to improve their people by understanding how each of their people are different. Because you can't manage everyone the same, and everybody's got their own little idiosyncrasies, and also what motivates them and what doesn't. And being able to coach to that or to motivate to that or whatever makes them far more effective. And at the same point in time, we also then help them as far as improving their culture by basically trying to humanize people. So it's like, okay, there are a lot of people out there, particularly these days or whatever, who are very into data. And it's like it's all about the numbers. It's all about the reports. Or it's like they're all about trying to improve performance.
I know those people.
Okay.
Yeah. So when they're not performing well enough, how do they manage that?
Well, so the thing is that you don't manage performance. You manage people who will then improve the performance.
Got you.
And so if you make the people better, then it's like the performance gets better. But that has to start with you being a better manager to start out with. Otherwise, you have no hope of making the people better, thus making the performance better.
In other words, if they don't respect you, they're not going to listen to you kind of thing?
Well, that's absolutely true. And we see that true in a lot of – with age, for example.
Wait a minute.
Well, because we have – for example, we have the younger workers or whatever.
Do not get me started.
If you're not technologically proficient, right? It's like if you can't work your CRM or whatever, how the heck are you going to tell me what I should be doing with the CRM?
Right.
And or you're too young to manage
exactly
me.
Exactly right.
What do you know?
Exactly right.
I don't think that technology has an age barrier. I think it just has a...
It's a mindset.
But I can tell you that the younger people will not listen to the older people if they're not technologically equal.
Absolutely correct. I mean, even maybe a little bit superior because they think that they're superior just because they're younger. I grew up with this stuff my whole life, and you had to learn it when you were 50.
Exactly. So, Lee, we're going to talk about Team Keeper when we get back, but I just wanted to say thank you so much for coming on our show today.
Yeah. We want you for another episode.
I would love to stay for another episode.
Cool. We need more nerds. We don't have enough. Most of the
people. We're very nerd-friendly, Jeffrey. Yeah,
sell or die, we're nerd-friendly.
Nerd-friendly.
So thank you and have a safe journey home.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lee.
Well, that was pretty damn insightful. I thought that was one heck of a discussion.
Lee knows his stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Lee's on it.
Without a doubt. And, when we talked about the fact that he was very data-driven, obviously, but when we talked about the fact that data is calming, what it meant to the salesperson or what it can mean to the salesperson, when you're in the sale and you're nervous and looking for a way to either connect with somebody emotionally or get more truth out of that person or even close the sale, the more data you have, the more relaxed you are about the potential outcome.
Well, it creates confidence.
Right. You know the why. And you know all the details of the why. And the more you can articulate that without being boring, the more confidence you're going to transfer to the customer.
So the question for you as a salesperson is how much data do you have when you're going into a sale? How much research do you do prior to the sale? And what kind of discovery are you coming in with?
And how relevant is that to the customer? You can have all the data in the world, but if it's not relevant to the customer, it's not going to mean that much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you have to take the we out of data. And you have to put the you in data, and that will immediately say, who's this data in favor of? Are you trying to create some fear or some kind of find the pain in the data? No. I want to find the value in the data. That's if I'm looking for that, I'm going to go there. You?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay, cool. So now there's one other thing that actually got me in this interview.
Yeah.
When Lee Smith said, it's not just the bricks, it's also the mortar. I'm like, woo, doo-doo-doo-doo.
He should make that a quotable on Instagram.
Yeah, he should trademark the damn thing, I thought. But what he's talking about is that your people make the bricks work, and it's your people that form the culture inside of your company and create the opportunity for you to succeed beyond your goals or your sales plan.
Well, he also went into the fact that culture is not just what the manager says it is, but it's what the people say and feel and how they react to the culture. And it's sort of like value. Okay, you could tell me something has value, but if I don't perceive that value to be there, it's not there. If the employee doesn't perceive the culture to be what the manager says it is, it's not there.
No argument with that. I have felt for the longest time that the people control the process. One of the failings that I found when I read Good to Great was the missing piece was treat your employees better than you treat your customers. Because if you don't treat your employees better than you're treating your, you know, everyone says, oh, treat your customers like gold. No, no. You treat your employees like platinum. And they will in turn treat the customer like gold. But if you have an internal culture that's I don't know how to explain, but let's say it's just a negative culture where the boss is a jerk and there's high demands put on people and there's all kinds of rules that are put in the workplace, it's going to be reflected to the customer.
Yeah, absolutely. The mentality that was ingrained in me growing up was that your employees are like an extension of your family in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And you treat them like that, they begin to feel like that. And then they will care for your company and treat your company as if it's their own.
I read a thing this morning online that said, if you have a friend for more than 7 years, it's like family.
If you have a friend for
for more than 7 years, you start to treat them like family. And that could be good and bad. You know what I mean? They come to your house and drink your soda. But the bottom line is that you become more familiar with them. And that's the whole essence of a culture is positive familiarity.
Mm-hmm.
And if I have positive familiarity, I'm going to have a company that's rolling. I mean, you look at what we have, and Doug, you can corroborate this we have a weekly meeting. And that weekly meeting is full of ideas, full of smart people, full of positive energy, and no one ever leaves and goes, damn meetings, I hate the damn meeting. it's good, and it allows everyone to have their voice.
Yeah, we keep it fun, we keep it light, but we keep it tight too. That's my key mm-hmm. to meetings is always make sure you're on task because your meeting can be extremely fun, but if it's extremely long,
then it's extremely wrong.
Exactly.
We have a note taker and a timekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
And
Doug's the bellman.
And Doug is the bellman.
If we get off topic, he hits that bell.
We actually have a bell. It's pretty cool. But everyone's prepared. Everyone has notes. And everyone's ready to talk for their portion of it. It's very participatory. So anyway, that was Seeley Smith. And we got the...
All right, let's go over this Yes Attitude contest one more time.
All right.
All right. Here's what you need to do to win the day in Charlotte with Jeffrey. Record a video talking about why and how your yes attitude has changed your life. Simple, get your iPhone out, record that video, post it to YouTube, and title it, Jeffrey Gittimer Gave Me a Yes Attitude.
If you own the book Yes Attitude, then you reread some of those passages that you highlighted 10 years ago, and you remind yourself what led you down the path of Yes Attitude, and record that.
Mm-hmm. So you record your video, you post it to YouTube, and then you share it out to your social platforms. It's really that simple. Tag Gittimer in it so he knows you've done it. Hashtag Yes Attitude, hashtag Gittimer. And the more times you share, the more potential you have to win.
I will see you in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Ooh.
And until then, are we finished for the day?
Yeah, I think we're done. I'm about to go get some Death Wish coffee.
Oh, get me a cup.
All right, I will.
And my name is Jeffrey Gittimer, and
I'm Jen Gluckow.
We're reminding you to get out there and sell something, even if your ass falls off.
Oh, yeah.